Catherine Sammy, welcome to KABU.
Thank you so much, Johanna. It's great to be here.
Catherine Sammy teaches at University of California, Irvine in the Gender and Sexuality Studies Department. She's the author of a book about Iranian feminism called Axis of Hope, Iranian Women's Rights Activism Across Borders. Great to have her here with us on KABU today to talk about the struggle and protests that are going on in Iran as we speak. 4 weeks of protests, absolutely unprecedented. Catherine, you want to give us a little snapshot of what is happening now?
Sure. I mean, probably as most listeners know by now, the protests that, yes, have been going on for, gosh, I think 25 days, 26 days, were sparked by the killing of Mahsa Rajina Amini, a young Kurdish-Iranian woman, arrested for, quote-unquote, improper hijab. So this is an incredible moment where you have seen a kind of outpouring of activism on the streets and social media, led by primarily young women. Now in its fourth week, and this is true from sort of the very beginning, incredible widespread support of many sectors, many people in Iran. So it is a really incredible moment. There's been, of course, a lot of arrests, a lot of violence, killings and deaths of protesters, but people are not stopping and they're not backing down, and it's incredibly inspiring, and we're all just watching it unfold in these beautiful ways and also holding our breath and just hopeful that some deep change will happen. And what's, you know, particularly interesting and completely new is the kind of widespread and central demand for the end to the Islamic Republic. And certainly for many of us who have studied women's movements in Iran, this is a particularly new and central demand that is now widespread, which is also not a look back to the Shah. It's not a support for the monarchy or any other kind of authoritarian government. So it's really a protest against the kind of patriarchal authoritarianism of the Islamic Republic and of the state, and a protest against the kind of state violence that is used to keep citizens in line.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is so interesting in this movement is the way in which people are challenging Islamic authoritarianism, a kind of state-imposed Islamic rule. And at the same time, unlike many of the movements, the way the West understands what's going on is that this is a struggle for secularism and against Islam. And I think it's important to talk about the ways in which the Western eyes have distorted what women want, what women are doing, and what the people supporting this new women's movement want.
Yes, you know, this has been sort of one of the traps, one of the triangulations that have confronted us as both feminists and anti-imperialists. Well, first of all, of course, as you said, a kind of Western gaze of Islamophobia that has kind of punished and isolated Iran, you know, since the revolution. Certainly the U.S. and other Western powers have had this kind of singling out of Iran, talking about the kind of exceptional violence of the Islamic Republic. Meanwhile, of course, you know, killing Muslims in Afghanistan and Iraq and many places in the world. So the kind of Islamophobia before the Iranian revolution, but that really, you know, you see a resurgence of this after the revolution and a real misunderstanding of both the revolution and also the post-revolutionary government and society, which was very nuanced for many years. And actually part of the protests break with a kind of decades-long struggle in these different moments to try to kind of force the state to fulfill some of its promises that it made during the revolution. And so, yes, there's the kind of geopolitical larger backdrop that some, of course, on the right, certainly, but even some kind of liberal media is really focusing on this down with the Islamic Republic. And this is what the protesters are calling for, but they're not against Islam. You know, many of them are Muslims or secular Muslims or even, you know, more religious Muslims, hand in hand, side by side. The citizens of Iran for a long time, I talk about this in my book, have really argued for and articulated, you know, a different vision of Islam, not one kind of harnessed by and captured by this patriarchal authoritarian government. And people have for a very long time said, this is not our Islam. This is not what the revolution was for. This is about the state having a particular understanding of that. And there have been different moments. I mean, of course, the state historically, as any state, has had kind of mixed actors, some reformists, some hardliners, a kind of real debate in the society for many decades now about what Islam means. And people have really inserted themselves and said, this is not Islamic. You are using Islam in the name of state violence, and this is not our Islam. So this particular struggle, whereas previous struggles have been very aware, obviously Iranians have been aware of the fact that there's so much Islamophobia. There has been Western encroachments on Iran for years and years and years, certainly more than just post-revolution, but, you know, the overthrow of Mossadegh. Even before this, patronizing imperialist relationship to Iran, and the revolution was an anti-imperialist revolution. So for many years, it was difficult, although not impossible, but kind of difficult to figure out, well, how do we critique what's going on in Iran? How do we critique state repression without playing into the kind of, you know, neoliberal, conservative, or even sort of liberal understanding of Islam that paints Muslims and Islamic governance as somehow more problematic than secular governance. But these sorts of discussions and these tensions, they're not present in the way that they have been before. People in Iran, they're not worried about Islamophobia. They are in a liberation struggle, and they are critiquing the Islamic Republic, right? The patriarchal Islamic state, and they are also critiquing intervention. They're not asking for the West to come save them, and they're not worried about being co-opted by the West. They are for liberation. They're against state violence. They're against repression of any kind.
One of the parts of the analysis that I've read, and I think you have mentioned this to me as well, that it's not accidental that this movement is sparked by and led by a new generation of Iranians who largely, mostly, are very little connected to the history of the Republic and in some ways take it for granted. And what they really have experienced is the crushing economic mismanagement, the inflation, the inability of the regime to provide, as you say, any of the things that were promised as part of the revolution. And there have been in the past years, and especially over the past 4 years, some very big protests in Iranian society around these kinds of issues, economic, social issues, issues of the oppression of minorities within Iran. And it seems like in this moment, although it begins with a protest against the morality police and the enforcement of compulsory hijab, the movement very quickly expands to incorporate many of these other grievances in a kind of women-centered politics. And it's captured, I think, by the slogan that has emerged, which is women, life, freedom.
Yes, absolutely. It is both about the end to compulsory hijab and about the right to a dignified life. Those things have come together under the sign of woman, life, freedom. I mean, I might choose a different word than expand, because I think in some ways the kinds of widespread critique was always there. You know, it was about the excessive state violence, the deprivation, the control of the body, right, through women. Of course, this is always what happens. The state securitizes itself through women's bodies and restrictions on what you can do with your body and on sexuality. So it's absolutely about that. And it's very specific to Iran. It's not about an end to hijab everywhere. It's about an end to compulsory hijab in Iran as a representation of the way that the state has offered a vision of security, you know, onto women's bodies, and that the woman life freedom has this deeper, as you say, critique of the different kinds of deprivations, particularly that people have experienced in the last 5 years. You know, for many, many years, even decades following the revolution, the kind of post-revolutionary government did many things to improve people's life chances. At the time of the revolution, women were having an average of 7 children, and several years into the post-revolutionary period, that goes down to 2 because of increased access to education, increased access to healthcare, increased literacy, a general improvement in well-being for many women who were shut out of the Shah's regime. You know, the Shah improved life for only a small sector of people. So for many years, people felt like, oh, the quality of their life got better. And some people, not everybody, there have always been some people left out of that project, including ethnic and religious minorities and some sectors of workers. But there was a kind of sense for a while that, yes, the people who supported the government, they didn't like the discriminatory structures against women, and they fought them because of their investment in what the revolution promised. But the last several years, you have seen the shrinking of the middle class, the general kind of widespread immiseration because of the mismanagement of the economy, the mismanagement of the COVID pandemic. Of course, sanctions really exacerbating that economic struggle. Sanctions really is a form of economic warfare. Could even say terrorism. And so all of these have combined to really kind of gather everyone as united in both the kind of widespread suffering and immiseration and anger at the government for failing people, for leaving people hungry. I mean, some of the protests in the summer before all this happened in July, you know, and in the spring were so incredible were these pensioners or, you know, kind of organized in a union who were protesting saying our tables are empty. We don't have enough to buy food. Women saying to the Basiji, to the military police who are trying to hassle them, don't you buy chicken? Don't you buy oil? Don't you buy stuff to eat? Like, we don't have enough to buy food. So one of the slogans that started appearing shortly after Woman Life Freedom was bread, work, freedom, and an end to compulsory hijab. So all of these, as you said, come together through a kind of feminist vision of liberation that says, instead of the violence against our bodies that is happening in these different ways, we want care, we want a world, we want a government, we want a society that provides these basic freedoms and basic necessities.
This is Johanna Brenner. You're listening to KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is Old Mole Variety Hour, and we're speaking with Catherine Sammy, who's an author and professor at UC Irvine in the Gender and Sexuality Studies Department, about what's going on in Iran. It's a field that she knows quite a bit about because she wrote a book about Iranian feminism called Axis of Hope, Women's Rights Activism Across Borders. Catherine, we've just been talking about the ways in which this protest has integrated so many different needs and issues, demands, and feelings among the population. This protest has been going on for so many weeks, despite the intense repression that people are experiencing. I mean, jailing, beatings, people in detention, hundreds of people have been killed by the police and military forces. It's an incredible demonstration of popular courage. Could you talk a little bit about what you think explains that in this moment?
Yeah, it's still unfolding, and you know, there's so much we don't know. But I think a few things. I think one, we've kind of talked a bit about this, that this is led by primarily young people who have a different relationship to the revolution and the post-revolutionary society, unlike generations of women and others who, as I mentioned, participated. I mean, there's a long history of women's movements in Iran, of feminist movements, and you know, the movements that I talk about are about particularly reform campaigns that, again, said, look, we supported the revolution, the kind of promise of the new society, so we're here in the revolution, and the kind of post-revolutionary decade gave us education and literacy and a presence in society. So that's at odds with this discriminatory legal structure, and we want to challenge that. We kind of want to reconcile our actual presence in society with a gender equal legal framework. But I think this younger generation, they don't have the same relationship to, you know, what the revolution promised. They've come of age with climate disaster, with the rivers in Iran drying up, with the economy tanking, with the currency tanking, with, you know, COVID mismanagement, with, again, this kind of widespread suffering, and then with an incredible, like, turn to the right and targeting again of women's bodies as the kind of place where the state maps its securitization onto. So the, you know, the policing of women's bodies, the control of women's bodies. And this younger generation, I think, is set up. Obviously, the excessive violence of the morality police instigate this, but, you know, they're part of the world, I think, in a way that lots of younger generations always are. You know, they're connected through social media in ways that older generations haven't been. And they, again, they just have a distance from the revolution and the kind of post-revolutionary conversations and ideologies and struggles. Their world is a different world, and they are different with each other. You know, they are, like so many young people, interested in more kind of democratic, horizontal relationships with each other. Gender and sexuality are really central, as is feminism. So certainly at the rallies in the U.S. among the Iranian diaspora, links have been made around trans and queer Iranian bodies and their oppression and the oppression of women. And I think part of it is reflected in this generation. And then I think they have captured people, because even the people who might be scared to go out on the street and kind of put their bodies on the line in the same way, they have been struggling for so long. They have, you know, been trying to make demands on the government, and they have been trying to push the government to meet their demands. And, you know, they've just also been abandoned. And as I said, through economic hardship and hunger and climate crisis and the COVID mismanagement, they're angry too. So their anger has been ignited. It's almost as if they've been willing to try to seek reform for so long, and look where they are now. And so these young people, I think their anger and their bravery and their courage and their love and their joy in the streets and their finding, you know, new ways to be together has really sparked people's anger, but also people's desire for an end to the oppression of everyone, you know, from workers to poor people to ethnic and religious minorities, to queer people, to women. So I don't think I'm the only one saying this. I think we're all trying to understand, you know, why is this so different? And those are, I think, some of the reasons that we can point to that, you know, this is why this is still going, why there's so much widespread support for it, why it looks a little bit different than some of the protests of the past.
Well, Catherine, that was wonderful summary of where the movement is at right now. I want to thank you so much for being with us today to unpack what's going on in one of the most significant and courageous uprisings that we've seen in Iran history. So thank you so much for being with us today.
No, thank you so much for your interest in the struggle and for having me. It's been great to talk to you.